This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Losing a loved one is always a hard and complicated process, and that is especially true when a child loses someone close. Renee Alexander Kraft lost her grandmother when she was 7 years old, and a few years ago, she saw her best friend succumb to breast cancer. Her friend had two young daughters who inspired Renee to create something that could help them heal. So Renee did what comes naturally. She wrote a book. Her latest is I Will Love You Everywhere Always, and it tells a story of eternal love that transcends death. Renee's work often gives voice to overlooked and unheard narratives. Since she was a child in rural Charlotte, she's written about creative ways individuals and communities navigate the challenges of day-to-day life. Renee Alexander Kraft is an artist, ethnographer, and professor of communication studies at UNC Chapel Hill. And she joins me in the studio today. Renee, good to have you here.
Great to be here.
Tell us about growing up in Charlotte in the 80s.
It was wonderful. I often say I grew up across the street from Charlotte because our area got annexed into Charlotte later. So the area I grew up in was still full of farmland and places for girls like me to climb trees, be able to bike ride to parks nearby. It was lovely.
You grew up in a Protestant community, but went to a Catholic school.
I did.
What was that like? Tell us about that.
Looking back now, I see all of the ways it gave me a good critical eye and a really nice solid foundation. So I grew up going to a Presbyterian church. My dad's family is Presbyterian, and my mom's family is AME Zion. And we didn't have one of the things that my mother worried about was daycare. So I started going to Catholic school really because they had daycare. Their plan was for me to leave Catholic school in about third grade, but I had a different plan. I made friends there. I really loved it there. And so I ended up going from kindergarten through 12th grade through Catholic school.
And it caused you, I understand, to question. There were questions that
yes.
you had having to be part of two worship communities.
Yes. Part of the thing I think that would have been interesting even without going to Catholic school, I have a great family, and my dad has a healthy sense of cynicism and criticism. So he's a man of faith, but he's also a man who doesn't believe in taking anything wholeheartedly that might contradict inner truths. So he's a man who always believed in questioning anyway. Getting to grow up in both of those spaces made it safe not to have to take any of it whole, to ask questions, to not know, to not believe certain things as much as to believe. So it let me kind of eclectically build my own faith practice and my own relationship with a creator by my own rules. And that was valuable.
So it sounds like it was okay to ask questions at home. How about at the Catholic school? Because I went to one of those.
Yes, that didn't go over so
great. That's not when I was going, but I'm just wondering if your experience was different.
Yeah, it didn't go over so great. I remember, as a lot of kids, anyone really who engages the Bible and tries to take pieces of it very, very literally, I was trying to figure Genesis out. And I thought, okay, let me try to get this straight. So there are these two people, and all of a sudden we skip apart, and there's a whole, there seem to be countries of people. There seem to be nations of people. So how did that happen? I know a little bit about the birds and the bees. I'm trying to figure it out. And when I tried to raise that question at school, I was reprimanded and given a lecture about belief and faith.
Mm-hmm.
When I raised it at home, they said, I don't know. I don't know. We can look at the story in the Bible. We can talk about what it means as an allegory. We can talk about what it means, in this particular way. But it was great not to know. It was great to hear grown folks say, I don't know either.
Yeah, you should see what happens when they say, there's actually two stories. I noticed there's a creation, and then they kind of start over and they tell it again. Sister, why do they tell two stories and why are they different? Don't ask that either.
No, I can't imagine that going very well.
I ended up having a great deal of respect for those folks, too, and it sounds like you did. So the conflict for you, when they couldn't quite give you an answer or they said, just take it on faith, I mean, how did you take it? It sounds like you wanted to stay. It didn't turn you away.
Oh, not at all. I think the way my mind worked was, oh, don't ask you. I thought,
there you go.
I thought, ask somebody else. But I was nurtured in my experience. I went to a very small Catholic school in Charlotte, Our Lady of Consolation, and it happened to be located in a predominantly African-American neighborhood. So it ended up being, by geography, a predominantly African-American Catholic school, and it was very small. The smallness of it, you know, may have heard it over time. My class was the last eighth grade class to graduate from the school, but that smallness meant a lot of individual attention. Mm-hmm. It meant getting to spend time early thinking about what a spiritual core might be like, getting time to kind of build that for myself and have that not be separate from a life of the mind. Mm-hmm. So that has proved valuable to me.
High school experience was a little different. Tell us about that.
It was. So although my elementary school was predominantly African-American, my high school was predominantly white. It was Charlotte Catholic High School, and it was the feeder school for all of the various Catholic
mm-hmm,
schools.
Yeah.
So I remember going from, going into the situation where I was one of almost 18 African-American students in the whole school between ninth grade and 12th grade, and being a little intimidated by that, a different feel, wondering how I would be looked at and if I would be accepted in various ways. I was fortunate that before going, I didn't have a lot of negative experiences around race. My parents are people who grew up in the segregated South and who, to their credit, never let some of their wounds wound me. Instead, they tried to build a nurturing cocoon around me, but give me what I needed to be watchful and wary. And it ended up, again, Charlotte Catholic was a great experience.
Were there tensions, though? It would seem to me. Now, that's Charlotte in what, late 70s, early 80s?
This is Charlotte in really late 80s, in terms of when I went to high school.
By high school,
late 80s, yeah.
And so were there tensions in that school? You one of 18 out of 1,500, 2,000 kids total?
To the school's credit, there weren't strong tensions around race, in that there weren't moments that felt racist or that I, in that way. Instead, the tensions came more around a well-meaning, the school meant well in their attempts to neutralize race. But neutralizing race neutralizes difference.
Mm-hmm.
That difference is a difference I brought with me, whether or not we talked about it. So creating an environment so that we didn't really talk about difference in an effort to make us be able to hold hands and move forward and be one was a false construct. So the tensions came around not being able to acknowledge difference and then talk about it and ask questions about it and learn about it.
So you go to UNC in 1991, and the first week you're there, you have this encounter with Michelle Thompson.
Michelle Thomas.
Tell us about that.
It absolutely has made a difference in terms of my whole trajectory. It was wonderful. I was a freshman on campus. I'd been going back and forth to UNC for different summer camps for years because I knew I wanted to go to the school. At the time, I wanted to be a journalist. And so I was taking every opportunity to be there. And I happened to be with a good friend of mine at the time, Lee Richardson, who introduced me to Michelle Thomas. She was an upperclassman who had come out of the Sonya Haynes Stone Black Cultural Center. At the time, it was still the Black Cultural Center. I was fortunate enough to enter UNC when Dr. Stone was still alive. And she was a mentee of Dr. Stone. So she met me on the steps, and Lee introduced me to her. And her first question to me was, "What will your legacy be at UNC?" And I thought, I just got here.
I'm 18 years old.
Wow, I don't know. But the beautiful thing about being asked that question as I entered campus, it meant that I started wrestling with two things. One, the great possibility that someone like me, from a small school like me, from a small community like me, could have a legacy at a big place like UNC. So I thought about what are the skills and talents I've brought with me. I thought there are big things that people like Michelle were doing at the time, leadership roles within the Black student movement and building toward the building of a freestanding Black cultural center. And I thought being at the vanguard, leading that, is not necessarily my mission. But what can I do? And I've loved to write since I could write. And I thought, I'm a writer. I love art. So maybe it could have something to do with that. As I moved around campus, I naturally started aligning myself with other people who love the arts. And I noticed how many visual artists and poets kept their work in tattered notebooks or under their beds or in small places that you would never encounter unless you knew them. And they were talented. Mm-hmm. And I wanted there to be some place where other people could experience that. So I decided to create a literary magazine, and it was called Sauti Umpia.
Which means?
It means new voice. It's Swahili for new voice. And I started going to see about how to make that so. At the time, the center was led by Margot Crawford, a wonderful, wonderful woman. I went in under Michelle's urging, and I kind of timidly said, you know, I'd like to create this new product, this new magazine, and she encouraged me.
And you did, and we will find out more about that after the break. I'm talking with Renee Alexander Kraft on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Renee Alexander Kraft today, an artist, ethnographer, and professor of communication studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Tell us more about the literary magazine you started.
So when I went in to talk to Margot about doing it, I didn't know how she might respond. You know, consider it later, wait till you're an upperclassman. Instead, she said, get an editorial board together, and here are some people to consider. She sent me toward Marion Phillips, who was over in the medical school and who's a poet, also a wonderful supporter. So I did that. I got a great coalition together of students, and we were able to put it out. And
why do you think you talked about the all of this work sort of being hidden away in notebooks and under the bed? Was that simply because there was no outlet, or because there was resistance to it?
Well, I think a little bit of both, to be honest. I think that a number of friends talked about submitting their work to campus publications, but either getting rejected at times or not feeling as though they had a space. And I wanted there to be a space for this work that I thought was so strong, but also a space to create good dialogues about what it is to be a citizen of the Black/African diaspora, what it is to be, how you engage that notion of citizenship and belonging through art, through poetry.
Well, there's always that important question, I think this raises it, about having a separate space for a particular identity, particularly when it's a minority identity within
right.
an institution like UNC. Talk more about the value of that and why it's important not to simply – because it seems to me it goes back to your experience in high school. I mean, this word tolerance means we're not acknowledging the difference that we have to talk about.
Right.
That has to be expressed as it is to then get to some kind of synthesis that everybody really wants to get to.
Right. I think part of the value in it to me has always been a space to get to have good, sustained dialogue within community and to expose that dialogue to a broader community. So I think that the conversations between multiple communities are extremely important. But I also think getting to hash that out, getting to see how a community is dealing with its issues, its concerns, its politics, and having a space where those conversations happen across multiple platforms, it's just useful.
So there are no shortcuts. We'd love to get past it, but we can't get past it until we get through it. And we can't
right.
get through it without acknowledging the
difference. You can't pretend it away.
Yeah.
You can't act as though it doesn't exist. I think that it just kind of festers and stays there. I think the ability to speak injustices and to speak wrongs and to speak hurts gives an opportunity to a broader public to talk about that.
And talk more about the Black Cultural Center, which became the Sonya Haynes Center. But tell us about that, because you were involved in that evolution and that change, and that was not an easy fight either.
Exactly. So the Sonya Haynes Stone Center for Black Culture and History is an amazing space. When I was on campus, we existed in a space we call the Fishbowl, which was within the Union. It was windows on all sides because of its particular location, but it was such a wonderful testing ground for new ideas and concepts. There were lounge chairs all around for students, faculty, staff, community members to hash out important conversations. And so it was an important space. While I was there, people like Michelle Thomas was president of the Black Student Movement at a time we were marching toward the center. And we were the second or third generation of students to kind of take up that mantle in different moments. My college experience ended up very much being framed by that struggle. So between that struggle, the work with Saudi Umpia, the activism on campus, my time on campus was really marked with art and activism.
How did it happen? Because the struggle was to get out of the fishbowl and to have a building,
right, a
separate space that would be constructed.
Exactly.
And become the Sonya Haynes Stone Center. How did it happen? How did it come about finally?
A number of coalitions worked together to push the administration toward this new horizon. And eventually that agitation worked well. And the coalitions really spearheaded by the Black Cultural Center's advisory board and the group of people who were working to support them planned out what that might look like, what that might be like. It took, I think, almost a decade. I can't remember in terms of the temporal frame to be able to get it and to see the building come to fruition.
We should probably take this opportunity to talk about Sonya Haynes Stone herself and her contribution to the university and why this institution and building is named for her.
Right. She was a stunning professor who, again, believed in the brilliance of students, believed in the power of collectivity, was a great mentor to so many people. I wish I had had the opportunity to work with her. She was one of the people who sparked the fire in Michelle Thomas to be able to move forward in the struggle. And sadly, she passed away my freshman year. But she had done so much amazing work through her scholarship, her activism, her work on campus.
So you did get your undergraduate degree and helped move that transition forward to creating the center. What'd you do after that? You left Chapel Hill?
I did. I'd always wanted to be a journalist, and I had decided I was going to be a magazine journalist. It was all I had prepared to do. So I went to New York. I worked for a magazine. I checked my dream off my list, and I started at it, and I hated it.
You worked for Cosmopolitan.
I did.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for Cosmo. I had been a part of an internship program called the American Society of Magazine Editors, which circulated my resume after I finished that internship my junior year. Cosmo is one of their member organizations, saw my resume, gave me a call, and asked if I wanted to come in for an interview. I did. I went there. And our politics aren't quite the same.
Uh-huh.
So it wasn't the best match for me. It was a great thing to get to experience. But my time there, you know, was marked with different moments that were more tinged with race.
How so? At a place like Cosmopolitan in New York. Yeah.
Well, I was one of three Black employees when I was there on the editorial side, and I was an editorial assistant for two senior editors, one of which had a particular way of talking to her assistants in general and talking to me in a way that was derogatory and had some racist tinge to it. Yeah. I remember calling my mom at a certain point because I had gotten very frustrated and very disillusioned. But this was the only thing I'd prepared to do. I really didn't know what not doing it would mean. I could go, I wouldn't, if I left this place, what would it mean about letters of recommendation? What would it mean about doing other things? And so I called my mom, who again was a child of segregation in the South, who said, I didn't work this long and this hard for you to have that experience. So if you need to quit, quit. Mm. And I did. So I quit and I went home and was terrified. I was in my New York apartment that I now could not afford with no job and no sense of what to do next. And I leaned back on some of the relationships I'd made at UNC. I'd had a wonderful relationship with Don Luce, who is in charge of the head of the Carolina Union. And at the time, the Carolina Union and the Performing Arts series were coupled together. And so I called Don to complain because I knew I'd be safe to do so. And I kind of said, Don, I'm in trouble. I just quit this job that I thought I'd love and I hated, and I don't know what to do with myself. And he said, well, you know, when you started this literary magazine, you were pretty good at begging for money. So you got me to give you money to support it. I have a new position for a fundraiser. Would you be interested in coming back and doing it? And my response was something like, yes, and double yes, and I will make my flight arrangements soon. So it would have meant a big cut in salary at the time because it was a new position, and I didn't care. I've loved UNC since I was a child. So the ability to come back and ask for money for something I believe in so thoroughly, which is the performing arts, that's an easy thing for me to do. So I did. And being back on a college campus was so invigorating. I was leaving an environment that felt much more cynical and going toward one that was so ripe with potential and possibility.
And even though the experience at Cosmo was not good, you did leave New York with an inspiration, Adrian Piper's work. Is that
yes.
right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, really, I funny enough, I did not come into contact with Adrian Piper's work in New York. I actually didn't come in contact with it until I began the master's program in communication studies at UNC. I'd been working for the Performing Arts series and the Union. As a fundraiser, and Diesel Yeni Madison, who had, you know, been a wonderful mentor of mine as an undergrad, saw me on campus and stopped me to ask me what I was doing. And by then I knew that I wanted to come back to school, that I loved getting to work for the Union, but that I'm a writer and I wanted more opportunity to get to write. So I had planned to go to an MFA program. And she stopped me and said, you know, asked me what I was doing. And when I told her, she said, no, you don't want to do that. And asked me to come up to her office and have a conversation. And she told me, you know, Renee, I know you. And you're going to want to engage this work. You're going to want to write your own work. But you're going to want to engage it with your body and through theory. You're going to want to figure it out in a way that is more embodied than you'd be able to do in an MFA program. You can't do that in some of the places you're thinking about applying, but you can do that here. So I applied, and I came in with an idea of I knew that I wanted to work around something about notions of blackness and black identity. What did it mean? At the time, I was fascinated with how it is we talk about people performing an identity versus how it is a sense of being an identity. And what that meant. And I didn't have any theoretical background to understand how to engage that. When I talked to Soyini about it, she suggested that I take a look at Adrian Piper, which I did. And I was very fascinated
Describe
with her work.
Describe that work.
Her work, she's a conceptual artist and philosopher, and her work deals with questions of race and identity, but she does it through these wonderful conceptual processes. So some of her physical artwork she calls guerrilla art. One of the first things I encountered was a piece called My Calling Card. And she talks about being a person whose phenotype, whose look doesn't necessarily mark her African identity, her African-centered identity. And so she talks about being in environments where people mistook her, did not know her background, and made these racist remarks. And she'd use this art object, this calling card, to give them. And the calling card was wonderfully snarky. I can't remember the precise text, but it said something like, "Excuse me, you know, if you did not know that I was, you know, a person of African descent when you made, laughed at, whatever, this racist remark." And the project wasn't just in the object, it was in the interaction, you know, what happened after, what happened in the moment. So I was fascinated by this person who was using art to engage questions of her own racial identity, as well as the broader concept of racial identities.
How does this get you then? Does it? Is there a connection between that and your work in Portobello, Panama?
Absolutely. So I was engaged in this project. I was a master's student, and I ended up getting to work with the Institute of African American Research with a wonderful person who was working alongside me, Michelle Lanier, who had gone down to Portobello she'd gone to Spelman, and she'd gone down with the Spelman College Summer Art Colony and Arturo Lindsay. And she had been trying to see if the Institute might bring him to give a talk about his research. We were able to do that. And as I watched his slide presentation and listened to him talk, I was hooked.
Talk about that community and its relationship with Portobello and the people in Panama.
So I looked at these slides, and they looked like uncles, aunts, grandparents, family members. At the time, all of the clothing that marked kind of hip hop fashion were also on their bodies. And I thought, I have to go meet these folks. This is an Afro-Latin community located on the Caribbean coast of Panama, whose trajectory and performance project comes from a history of enslavement. They link their cultural identity to the Cimarrones, who ran away to the hills and rainforest in Panama.
It might be also recognized as Maroons.
Exactly. Exactly so. So when I went down with the Spelman Summer Art Colony, I knew that I wanted my project to be something about the Congos, though I didn't completely know how to wrap my mind around who they were and what their project was. I loved the idea that they were that the queen in the Congo tradition, this carnival tradition, which really actualizes around carnival season, that were so powerful. And so I went down with this group of people. At the time, they included photographers, people interested in film, dance. There was a wood carver, several people who were visual artists, all working together on our discrete projects, but also living and working in this community with artists from the community. And that process, one of getting to engage this community as a fellow performer, artist, writer, in the midst of other artists and writers, gave a way of talking before my language skills existed in Spanish.
So here you have this community that is an organic community. They live there.
Right.
And then a kind of layer of artistic representation that grows quite self-consciously out of that. And
right.
They're all sort of coexisting in a place like Panama, so you're in Latin America, you see pictures that you instantly recognize. And
yes.
I wonder how that, and of course, these are people part of the African diaspora. How is that recognition different than seeing an art community, say, in New York, of African-American artists in New York City? In other words, what was happening to you? What struck you as more recognizable about that group of people?
I think part of it was the landscape. Part of it was witnessing them in a landscape that, if I had taken some of the pictures and shown you, you could have thought I was talking about a coastal community, an African-centered coastal community in rural North Carolina someplace. You could have thought, so something about the landscape, the kind of houses, the kind of adornments that I saw, not only in the community, on people's bodies, in some of the houses and the photography that I saw, that felt so familiar to me. I've grown up in the South, and I've grown up moving around these different African-American communities. You know, I talk about one of the, I love telling the story about when my mom came to visit me during my Fulbright year in Portobello, because she said it in a way that really brought it all together for me too. As any parent, she was worried about me traveling all over the place and didn't know this Panama thing, you know, that I was going to. And she got her first passport and came to visit me during my Fulbright year. And she stood on the balcony and said, "I know why you love this place. This reminds me of the Charlotte of my youth." And I knew in that moment what she meant. It was a place where it's a small town. So children, if you are coming in from elsewhere, you may see children moving around and not know that they're connected to all the houses they're passing by. They're not just moving all by themselves. They're with their cocoon with uncles and aunts and cousins, all of whom have the power to discipline them. That's the Charlotte she grew up in. And so something about that felt very familiar to me.
How did that connect, or did it, with that literary magazine that you had created as an undergrad at UNC?
I think part of the connection, and I love the question, I love getting to think about that, is about I'm fascinated by stories that I don't hear often and voices that I'm not exposed to. And so part of it connects, in terms of my broader project, with wanting to give exposure to these stories that are important, these artist communities that are so strong and that can be in good conversation with any arts community in New York, in Atlanta, in Paris, you know, any of these spaces, if more people knew about them.
I want to talk more about that. It's a fascinating parallel ideas. Exotic cultures, unfamiliar cultures that have an intimate familiarity when you see them brought together and rendered through art. Our conversation continues with Renee Alexander Kraft on the state of things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Renee Alexander Kraft, an artist, ethnographer, and professor of communication studies at UNC Chapel Hill. We're talking about your work in Portobello, Panama, and working with Congo people and the artist community there. You said something earlier about how you perform identity, how you perform blackness, and how that is different than feeling or being who you are. This sometimes confuses people. What do you mean performing my identity? What do you mean when you say that?
I mean the ways in which we, our gestural vocabularies, our the way we dress, the stories we tell about, you know, one another, our own backgrounds, the way we put our identities on our bodies. So everything from dress and movement, all of which we learn, all of which we get in our own communities. So how it is we figure out the norms of performing whatever identity we claim.
And does that suggest that because we use the word performance, which we think of as artifice, that it is mutable, that it changes from context to context when you find yourself in a different situation?
I think it's mutable within limits. I think that's part of what drew me to Adrian Piper's work. So part of what was fascinating to me about her is her phenotype gave her an additional mutability. She's a person whose body did not necessarily mark her. So the ability to perform or not perform, what there was a broader range. I'm not someone whose phenotype allows for that. So in both contexts, there is a policing on what is proper performance, quote unquote, air quotes, proper mm-hmm. performance and improper performance. And I'm fascinated about how communities police themselves, but also how onlookers, how outside communities police, you know, do some of this policing.
So now tell us how you came to write this book, which in many ways is a very different subject than what you'd been working on for most of your career. The book is called I Will Love You Everywhere Always. Tell
yes.
us about it.
So I had the wonderful fortune to meet Malaika Hardy Williams, at the time Malaika Hardy, as an undergraduate at UNC. We both were members of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority Incorporated together. We both loved the union and spent good time there. I was often in the union in the Black Cultural Center, and she was often working as president of the Carolina Union Activities Board and also kind of working behind the desk at the information counter in the union. So we had all of these ways of coming together. We were both from Charlotte and got to be great friends. My junior year in college, she was my best friend. So This is a relationship that sustained itself after school. When she found out she had breast cancer, I think it sent ripples among all of her community, her family, her friends, and those of us who were her age peers were terrified for her and for ourselves. We thought breast cancer was a thing we wouldn't have to think about for a bit. We thought we got a little bit, you know, more of a break from it. And part of her dealing with it was a wake-up call to us all to be more watchful and diligent. Malaika was always a fighter in the greatest of ways. And so we all rallied behind her, knowing that she would be able to beat it or sustain herself as long as possible. And although she eventually lost her battle to breast cancer, she did so having fought diligently and well for a long time, especially considering how aggressive the cancer was. So when it was clear, I think there were friends who had started to accept the inevitable earlier than I did. I wanted to stay on the train with her as long as possible and believing, even against mounting odds, that it was possible to beat it. And when I talked to her and heard in her voice the frustration isn't the right word, the overwhelming task of having to have a conversation with young daughters about this.
Two daughters.
I remembered from a kid's perspective what it was like trying to deal with a loved one's death. And I felt, as a friend, a bit helpless. I lived in North Carolina. She lived in Atlanta. I was able to come down at times and give physical help, but not nearly as often as I wish I could. But again, I fell back on the fact that I'm a writer. I'm an artist. So how might my art practice help? Help in multiple ways. Help in this conversation. Help in with this conversation with the girls. Help me as I'm trying to wrap my mind around what's happening. So I wrote a poem that decided it wanted to be this children's book, I Will Love You Everywhere Always. And in writing it, I wanted to put myself back in the place of being the little Catholic school girl whose grandmom died, whose family really assumed, between, you know, our own faith practice and my Catholic school time, that I understood more than I did. I could tell you quite coherently where I thought Mamo had gone, and about heaven and God and angels and a better place and not hurting anymore. But that didn't mean that in my quiet moments, I wasn't trying to make deals with God, because a God who could do anything could bring Mamo back and nobody had to know. It could be our secret. Or I remember making talismans, that these magical things that I would put under my pillow, and maybe the next morning I would go and she'd be where she always was. So, and I was 7, you know, I was older than both of Malaika's daughters were when they lost her. So I wanted there to be something, some way of saying, there will be people around you. There will be people who tell you rightly that I think she's in, you know, a better place and that she's happy. But you're not going to be, you know, not initially. You will find your way back to that. You will find your way back to peace. And one of the ways to find your way back is realizing she would never, ever leave you. She wouldn't do it. She's going to be with you every single day of your lives. All you have to do is be able to conjure up some of these positive memories. If they're not your own, let family fill you up with her stories. Remember her laugh. Remember some of the foods she liked to eat. Remember, take to heart when people say you have her smile, or that your auntie acts just like her, so that you have places to go and tangible places to look to find her.
Will you read for us?
I would love to. So this is an excerpt from the end of the book. I'll be waiting for you in the taste of maple syrup on pancakes, in the cold, soft wet of snowflakes, in the giggle your tummy feels when Daddy gives your toes a tickle. I'll hug you every time the wind blows. I'll kiss your eyelids every time your eyes close. I'll be Auntie Nima's softest touch. I'll be the stuffed bear you love so much. When you dance or sing or speak on stage and bow to look your daddy's way, I'll be the so big smile on his mouth. I'll be your Grammy's laughter and your best friend's cheers and shouts. Hope, baby, what I'm trying to say is that I will never leave you. I will love you everywhere, always. Hope knew that things would never be the same, but with Mommy all around her, she would be okay.
Renee Alexander Kraft, who is a professor of communication studies at UNC Chapel Hill and author of I Will Love You Everywhere Always. Did you come to this in the process of writing? Had you already your ideas about death, loss, and how we cope? Had they matured to this point, or did it happen in the writing of this poem?
I honestly think both are true. I realized that it took me 10 years, really, to be able to mourn my grandmother. And part of that is because I was afraid to talk about her very much in my family. I didn't want to make other people sad. So I was afraid to kind of ask questions and to share funny stories. And I was angry with her because she left. You know, in my young mind, I thought she had a choice and she chose to go. I didn't wrap my mind around fully what was happening to her body and in her life. So when I did and allowed myself to be angry and told myself I had full permission to do that, and then made space in my life to feel her and to talk to her, I know what that's like. I've never been to a job interview, a speech, a moment, a grand moment when she hasn't been right there with me. I'm sure she's right here right now. So it took me a while to come to that. And in my own, I think when we get scared because of grief or doubt or anything, some of the lessons we teach ourselves get short-circuited.
Well, you know, we're human, and the things humans really have to do and learn well is cause and effect. If I do this, that's going to happen. So you learn that, and you internalize it, and then you apply it to the loss of a loved one, and you do just what you said. Well, they left me, so there was a cause. It's me. I did it, or they did it.
Right.
And what this book does, and it's a beautiful book, and it's a lovely poem, is it offers these other dimensions, other ways of understanding your relationship, other causes, other effects. And an openness to listening to the things that you think might cause pain. But when they say you have her smile, let it in.
Exactly. I think the realization that grief is a long process and that you don't have to be by yourself in that, either not getting to talk to family or friends or people who remember great stories, but also talk to the loved one who's not physically here anymore, but who's still listening, and be open to all of the ways that life, the creator, the universe, gives back to you to feel, you know, those presses. I sometimes feel as though I'm moving around in the world and I may have a thought about my grandma and I feel the best breeze and I think, ugh, that's Mama giving me a hug. So being open to the fact that, you know, the universe can mean you well.
Tell us about the artwork in this book.
I was so fortunate, and this loops back around to Portobello, and Taller Portobello Norte, the arts organization I've been working with for years with Oranike Odeleye, going back and forth to Portobello. I went down a couple of years ago to keep working on my own research and met a wonderful artist, Cosmo White, as part of that process. And Cosmo, at the time, this wasn't in my mind, and you know, these chain of events had not yet happened. But he was doing this really gorgeous, painful but gorgeous work on funerary rites. And I loved his aesthetic. He works in charcoal and he works with collage. And he was looking at, part of his project in Portobello that summer was to look at some of the funeral practices in Portobello and to create installation art projects in conversation with them. And I thought his work was gorgeous. And so that kind of filed away. Mm-hmm. Years later, when Oranike and I were talking about this project, she mentioned, you know, you really should think about Cosmo with this. And I immediately went back to his work and thought, this would be amazing. And so he read the poem, he picked it up. He got the sense of the book initially. He got it right away. And he did not go start to finish in the way that he attempted to do the artwork. He let himself be led to whatever part of the story he did, and then entered into dialogue with it, with his own art practice, which is the way I really like to work.
The faces are emotional. They are African in their, or African American in their look. So you did not go with teddy bears, and you did not go with stylized.
No.
You cry when you read this, and then you come through it. Was that a decision? And, I mean, was it a difficult decision, and were there tensions around that?
It was never a difficult decision for me or for Cosmo. I think initially, when I thought about this book, again, it started as a very intimate project. I wanted to be able to do something helpful for the girls that they might be able to have and keep. And so it made good sense to me that the illustrations in the book would look like, you know, have a relationship to their mother and have a relationship to them. Midway through the process, I was doing this Indiegogo campaign, a potential supporter asked a family member why I hadn't chosen to go with either a more multicultural look. And what he meant by that was, instead of having it linked, let's say, to just one family, maybe every other page could be people from different spaces, people who represented different races and ethnicities. Or maybe I could go with butterflies or teddy bears or something, you know, that could be more universal. And my response at that moment was absolutely not, because this is a universal story that happens to be told through African-American bodies, these brown bodies and voices. But it's a story that anybody could connect to regardless of background. And I remember as a child, and I still don't see enough now, not having enough of these stories that looked like me. And I thought that the politics of representation matters, that we need more stories told through brown bodies that are universal stories.
I think anybody can approach this, but that's such an important lesson, that the particularities of individuals and groups can't be lost in the zeal to sort of bring us all together. That we can have a universal story without while still acknowledging these differences.
Right.
And it makes it more pointed. What about, and it is emotional, and then there's always the danger of saying, well, I don't want to make it too sad. You come through it. You very definitely come through it. But was there ever a tension about that?
I was worried. I was worried that, I don't know, I won't use the word worried. I was always conscious that that was a possibility. But once Cosmo and I partnered, that concern went away, because again, he got it. So his beauty, I love the interplay between his charcoal drawings, the black and white charcoal drawings, and these vibrant, rich color collages that he builds on top of it. So I knew it could not be just a black and white book. That would make it too heavy. It needed to have color. It needed to be beautiful. It needed to be an engaging children's book. And so he started scanning these wonderful fabrics, and he made sure to collage those on top of it so that you never lose yourself in that part of it. And I very much embrace it as a book about the main character I named Hope. And I think that's what it's about. It's about hope. It's about eternal love. It's about the notion that we never have to feel separated from the communities we claim. We just transition in our relationship to them.
Beautiful book. Thank you, Renee. So good to talk with you.
Thank you.
Renee Alexander Kraft, artist, ethnographer, professor of communication studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The writings and illustrations for I Will Love You Everywhere Always, the book that we were talking about, are on display through November 30th in the UNC Chapel Hill Student Union Gallery. That's the State of Things. Thanks for listening. You can find us on the web at stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.